For those of you just tuning in, you might be wondering what Friday Night Light is all about. And for those of you who have been here before, you might be wondering still what the hell is going on over here. So let me break it down. So Friday Night Light, L-I-T-E, is loosely based off of a phrase that I feel like I coined, but I feel like my kids would say, no, that definitely was not you. Totally was, but whatever. So about 5 years ago, here in Kansas City, they used to hold these free country concerts down in Power and Light. So every Thursday, I knew I was getting cute. I knew I was going to hang out with my homies, and I knew that I was going to get lost in the music and hopefully meet some new people. So on a Monday, I knew by Thursday, I was going out and having a good time. So Thursday ultimately became my Friday, but really Friday Light, because I still had to work the next day. So that's the whole concept of Friday Night Light, L-I-T-E, because this comes out on a Thursday. However, another step is that every time I would be out on a Thursday having a good time, I would get on Facebook and see people you may know. You know how those faces pop up and you're like, who the hell is this person? Well, I used to make total fun of it and be like, no, we're never going to know each other. But something clicked in me when I would see somebody's face or their name or this amazing piece of art as a profile picture and be like, hell yeah, I'm going to send a friend request to this person. And it didn't just have to be a cute bearded guy, although I really do appreciate them. It was somebody that maybe I saw on somebody else's post that I recognized, or somebody that just had a cool name, somebody had a piece of artwork as their profile picture, something that intrigued me in that moment. Of beverages or not, I felt that it was meant to be, and so I send a friend request. So fast forward, a handful of the people that I have interviewed slash shot the shit with on my podcast are people that I have great respect for. Everybody that I have added on my Facebook, I have great respect for, even if we don't agree. Everybody that I've added and has graciously accepted me has enlightened me, has educated me, has supported me, has made me cry, has made me laugh, has made me mad, but in the best fucking way. My newsfeed, my timeline does not look like my immediate friend group. Although my immediate friend group doesn't really look like my immediate friend group anymore, because I really want to be expanded in that way. And I feel that it starts right there with social media. And so many times social media gets a bad rap. And for me, it just hasn't been that. Social media has been a transformation of connection in the most amazing way. And wanting to do this podcast was just kind of another leap into that. I feel that everybody that I have interviewed and shot the shit with so far has something amazing to give to this world. And it's not fair that they should just share themselves on their own feed. They should be shared on everyone's feed. And so my concept for this podcast is that people that I don't know, but want to get to know, but don't actually know, I want to share their light with everyone. And so far, I feel very accomplished in that, because everybody in this world has something to give, everybody in this world has something to teach, and we all have something to learn. So anytime that you're out on a Thursday, a Friday light, and you're thinking, huh, I wonder if I should add that person, do it. Because their world is completely different than yours, or maybe it's the exact same, and then you can sit and talk about, holy shit, I'm not the only one going through this. Yeah, that's connection at its best. And social media gets such a bad rap, and this podcast is just a reminder that it doesn't have to be that. So I appreciate everybody who has been on my podcast so far that has shown their differences and their struggles and their accountability. You inspire me, and I hope by sharing your words and your light that you inspire so many more people. So enjoy every episode of Friday Night Light, L-I-T-E, on a Thursday or whenever you can get to it. Thank you. Welcome back to another episode of Friday Night Light. Tonight, meet my friend Laverne, a spunky, well-versed soul from Trinidad whose childhood inadvertently shaped her into the resilient person she is today. Stay tuned. Well, hello.
Hello. I'm like, is this a recording?
Is this thing on?
Is this thing on? Taps mic.
How are you?
I am well, well, well. I cannot complain. If I did, I'd be really, really ungrateful. So
I know that. I know that feeling.
Yeah. So, it's so good to finally talk to you.
I know.
After all these years.
I know. I was so Facebook finally got their stuff together again where it shows when you became friends with someone, and ours showed 2015. So it's
shut up.
I know. It's so wild to me to think that I've known you, quote, for 5 years, never met you, but still feel so connected to you.
That's the thing, right? With social media, it does that. And I'm so incredibly grateful for that, because light like yours, you know, you don't necessarily have the time to seek it or be around it, you know, with our lives going constantly. Mm-hmm. But that to be connected in this way via social media, like you said, even though you've never met someone and received their light that way, is just awesome. So
yes, and the whole premise of this podcast is that very reason, is that, you know, I'm getting to know people that I don't actually know, but I feel like I know.
Yeah,
just from being on social media and getting to know them that way. So yeah, I'm super grateful for it too. I'm already covered in goosebumps listening to you talk. It's so crazy.
Listen, I am just again happy that you. When I saw that you had launched the podcast, I said, wow, I can so see her. Never heard your voice per se in a conversation with you, back and forth between you and I. But I said, I can so see her spreading light through this podcast. And it's a perfect fit. Your personality, everything. I loved everything about it.
Yeah. Oh, well, that means so much to me. Yeah. Thank you for that. Especially coming from your background. So let's start with introduce yourself and who you are, what you do.
Sure. So Laverne Gordon, and I am the founder and president of an organization, awareness organization called Love Life Now Foundation, where we focus on, as I said, awareness and education around the issue of domestic violence. I am a two-time survivor of the issue, a child witness growing up, watching my father brutally abuse my mom in Trinidad, which is where I'm originally from. For those of you that don't know, that is an island, that is the last island, I should say, just above Venezuela. And so grew up there 15 years, watched it, always said that would never be me. And then subsequently falling into an adult relationship from the 21 to 23 with a man, and finally escaped. And 10 years later, I took part in a beauty pageant. Locally, I was dared to take part in it, did it, and ended up winning, and had to go on to nationals to, you know, try to get the title there. And at that point, I took it way more seriously and ended up winning there as well. So I had these two back-to-back pageant titles, and just knew that domestic violence was an easy platform to choose based on my experience. And so that's where the burgeoning for the work started. After the year was up with the pageant, I knew that I wasn't a pageant girl. I did it two times back to back, ended up winning, had a great experience, but I really wanted to continue the work that I had started over the year with domestic violence awareness. And here we are. 1 year later, after that happened, I formed a nonprofit.
Here we are. Wow. And that, I mean, I knew none of that. Like I know that you have this amazing foundation. It's done so well, and it started what in 2011? Is that when you started? Yeah. I mean, to actually have that platform and have it still be so successful and not get burned out by it, or have it even turn against you. You know, I feel like sometimes when you get involved in those things that it can sort of trigger you if you're not ready for that. And so I'm so proud to know somebody that is, you know, able to continue on with it. It's done so many great things. There's always updates about it. But I had no idea. I could sense an accent, so I'm glad that you told me about that. I had no idea that you were from Trinidad. That's amazing.
So I lived there till I was 15, with my parents and my four, God, I had to think about that, my four siblings. And then migrated to the States in 1993 to finish high school, and I've been here ever since. But yeah, that's where I'm from. And you know, I think as you relate to the whole issue of getting burnt out, which typically can happen, I think for me, in part, this has been therapy, along the way, getting to know people, coming into contact with folks that, you know, are on, you know, the prior side, and trying to get to the other side, having a part to play sometimes in that. We don't have a shelter, and as I said, we're focused on education, but being able to sort of have folks understand that this issue looks very different for everybody, but the same premises behind it are behind it, and having them see themselves in me through the work, is sort of, I don't know, just it fills me up. I don't know how else to say it.
Absolutely.
It fills me
Yes.
up, you know. Just this morning, as I said, we do not have a shelter, but right now we're helping a victim that had an attack a couple nights ago, and came my way by way of a friend that follows our work on social media. And she escaped, and she's at her family member's house and trying to leave the state because there's no shelter space immediately right this minute, to get to her mom in another state, a lot of miles away. And so we're going to be able to help her, through what's called our one of our initiatives called the Get Safe Fund. That, you know, if you leave a situation and you just need a leg up to get to safety, quote unquote, get safe, we can help you, you know, with domestic, I don't know, anything domestic violence expense related, you know. So we're gonna help her get a rent a car. We're gonna help her to rent a motel till the space is available for her in the state that she's going to. We're gonna help her with a gas card. You know, all of these things that relate to leaving and then getting to the point where you can actually sort of start getting your life back together. We help with that in-between transition through this fund. So I, again, this work fills me up. I don't know how else
Absolutely.
to put it. So I will tell you in the beginning, though, in starting this, that, you know, there were so many folks that were coming to me saying, you know, back then there was no, I at least I did, it probably existed, but I wasn't aware of it. The Me Too, right? There were so many folks coming to me saying Me Too, but I knew where to point them in terms of, you know, because that's what a lot of what we do too, is we point people in the right direction for help. But it was overwhelming at one point to get those calls Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday. And, you know, and this is the time that I'm supposed to be with family. I'm supposed to, you know, sort of be digressing. And I didn't know how to. I didn't have a boundary. And so I had to create those boundaries. And once I did, things ran a lot smoother. So now I know that I don't have to take it all, right? Right. I have to let folks know there's a certain time that we can be reached, because granted, we are quote unquote a hotline. I'm one person. And so hotlines typically have a lot more folks manning that. And so, you know, now we have the ability for folks to text us. So it's not necessarily that I'm spending, you know, a good hour on the phone on my off day, with someone. They can text, and it's easier for them, to relay what's happening to them in that way too. So anyway, I
Yeah.
digress. I don't get burned out anymore.
Yes. And that I think it's a true testament to, I think, just from what you've learned in your own experience with abuse, that in anything where we want to see it progress and see the potential of it, you know, the boundary is very, very important. So with anything that we do that we care about, we want to make sure there's a boundary. So that, and it's really hard because we don't want people to feel like we're leaving them out or letting them down. So, and that's a good point too, because the burnout is a high
It's
rate,
real.
you know?
It's
Yeah,
real.
it's definitely real. And I know that just from the little bit that I worked at the shelter here a couple years ago, you know, I was one of the people, the rare people that would give people my cell phone number, and same, I would have people blowing up my pager at 2 in the morning, you know, and it's like, oh gosh, I missed that. I hope they're okay. And so that's very, you know, and I think it's a true testament to who you must be as a person, because I can't imagine, you know, it's a true testament to you that you've put all of this into it, knowing that you grew up with it. And then you also fell into it as an adult yourself. I feel like it's made for you because of that reason, because I think so many people, they don't actually realize maybe that they're in an abusive relationship if it's just kind of a emotional thing. So I want to ask you a little bit about that. Do you, as far as how you grew up, is there any sort of like cultural point to that, as far as being from Trinidad and then, you know, moving here? I think for me, it's just a perspective, because I know we talk about the cultural aspect of things and how kind of, you know, man versus woman in their places. Was that something that affected your family?
So it's so funny, because in the area, so I come from the ghetto, and I say, you see what I did there? The ghetto. I really spiced it up. But so I come from a really, you know, not so great area. Okay. However, my father was lower, or would have been considered in my area, lower middle class. So he worked a government position, lower totem pole government position, and he was well read. So every morning I would see him reading a newspaper. He read a lot. He was articulate. He was the first in his family to go to college trade school, and like had charisma. He was charming, like for all intent purposes on the outside. If you saw this man, you would think, yeah, he's got it together, right? Even though we lived in the ghetto. Okay. And so my mom was the complete opposite. So my mom barely had an elementary school education, did not work. And for the most part, she depended on my father to take care of the family, right? And so once that sort of, I came about in 77, but didn't know myself till the, you know, mid 80s or so, I saw the dynamic immediately, where she was the caretaker and he was the breadwinner. I understood that, like, from like a very early on memory, 6, 7, right there. And so in my neighborhood, there was a mix of, you know, people not so well off, and when I say well off, like, you know, can make it, making a good salary, bringing home the bacon, so to speak, with maybe a few others that were sort of on my dad's level. And so in other households, this is one thing that, as a child witness to this issue, really made me feel helpless and not sort of really sort of confused around this whole thing, is that sometimes the attacks would happen to, he would bring the attack, he would drag my mom out of the house, and he would beat her in our yard, and in front of our house, sometimes more than few feet away from our house, and neighbors would come out and watch. And it would infuriate me, because I couldn't understand that the guys that he would hang out with on the block, why weren't they jumping on him to get him off her? Why weren't they stopping these attacks? And completely love hate with that whole dynamic, because as a child, you hurt for your mother. You want her not to be hit, not to have a machete used on her at times, not to have a beer bottle broken and she stabbed with at times. You know what I mean? And so you're sitting there with these brutal attacks happening and not understanding why people in the neighborhood aren't necessarily helping. And so it wasn't until I got older that I understood that why would they come help? Because in Trinidad, at the time, it was an absolutely accepted form of behavior to beat your wife. And so they were he was doing it in his household, and they couldn't come stop him because they were doing it in their household too, right? Because it was an acceptable form of punishment for your spouse, your girlfriend, because they didn't cook the rice right. And not say my mom's a phenomenal cook, I'm just throwing this out there, right? But she didn't, they didn't fold the clothes on time. Something happened on the outside that was a stressor to them, and they come home and take it out on their partner. Like, that was just the norm, right? And so nobody was necessarily trying to help. And even when the police were called, so we didn't have a landline telephone in our house, right? But if a neighbor who had one called and they showed up, my father was very articulate and could talk his way out of anything, and even sometimes make it look like she was crazy. Right. And
Which is
so,
typical,
which
right?
is absolutely typical. So back then, cops show up, and you know what? It's a husband and wife thing. Don't let us get a call again. Even if they get the call again, they're showing up, and you need to quiet it down. We don't want to have to take you down. And then they leave, right? Not even questioning her, not even trying to validate what happened to her. So that was the dynamic. And yes, absolutely, it was a cultural thing. Even within the dynamic of, as a Black family growing up in the area, there was also Indian families, which East Indian, but the Indian culture, the country itself, they have this dynamic where even more so, the woman has their place, and she's subservient. And subservient, and the husband has all rights to beat her if he needs to get her in line, right? For whatever reason. And within our own neighborhood, there was a family that rented from us. We had two houses, and so one of them was like a room and house type deal that we rented out to folks. And so they lived in one of those rooms. And so the husband would absolutely beat the wife. I mean, bloody hell, right? And this was normal. And for us as children, hearing this or seeing this sometimes, because this was so accepted, if it wasn't happening in our house, we would count it as, ooh, is she getting beat today? Man, is he using a belt on her? Like, it wasn't like, oh my God, that should stop because it's not happening in your house. Does that make sense? It's such a
Absolutely.
crazy, crazy dynamic. It was almost like, let's pull up a chair and hear what's going on. And that's what our neighbors would do with us, our family. So that definitely a cultural aspect. There are more countries like, Africa, where it is so absolutely okay. In India, completely okay. It's just. I just, like I said, it was something that was completely, it was to the point where child's play for me, Jen, was gathering up kids in the neighborhood. This was my out part of my outlet, besides laughing and trying to, have this exterior that everything was happy and good. I would pull up younger kids in my neighborhood and sit them like they sit them down like, do you remember LA Law with Blair Underwood?
Oh, hell yeah.
Girl, so I love that show growing up, and I would pretend to be one of the lawyers on LA Law, and I would want to, always be a lawyer or the judge, and the rest of the kids would be the jury. And in my mind, I would say to myself, when I grow up, I want to be a prosecutor. I want to be a lawyer so that I can put my father away, right? This is the way, this is the this was child's play for me. And from early on, I began sort of articulating the way he would, but then also marry it with LA Law and the Cosby Show and Claire and her assertiveness. And I always wanted to be sort of in that zone, like always trying to figure out a way when I grew up how I would take care of him. And now, don't get me wrong, I did love him. So there was this love-hate balance going on. I loved all the many things that were standout good, but I hated the monster he was behind closed doors. My two older siblings, they were abused as well, not as brutal as my mom, but the child abuse was real. I mean, he beat them, my older sister and my older brother, 7 years apart. They were 2 years apart from each other, but I came 7 years later. And by the time I came around, I saw that he beat them for stupid things, you know, go to school, do your work. He was very strict with us as children. And his idea of parenting was make sure we had clothes on our backs, food was on the table, and the bare necessities for getting to school. So school uniform and whatnot. There was no love, there was no I love yous, there was no hugs. There was none of that. And so by the time I came around and I saw the way that my older siblings got, I said, you know what? I'm going to do whatever it is that he wants to make him happy. So I went to school, I got good grades. I asserted myself. I was mannerly, you know, neighbors loved me. I always wanted to help. You know, I did my chores, like anything to stay on his good side, I did it. And so because of that, he would allow me to go spend, you know, a month at my cousin's house that they lived in a, you know, nicer area in Trinidad. Another month, another summer, you know, at my godmother's house, who lived in a different, nicer area in Trinidad. So I got to see that what we were experiencing at home was not normal, but there was nothing that I could do to change it, right, as a child. But my siblings obviously did not get that. I think he saw and he realized potential in me from very early on. So he was a little bit lax in that regard because my siblings, like I said, they did not get the sort of outer experience from where we lived. So anyway.
It's just, and it's crazy to think. I mean, just the little bit that you're saying about that you were, you know, assertive, but you were well-mannered. I mean, the way that your dad was definitely shaped who you are now in the best and in the best of ways, you know. And so I try, that's part of the spin of all this too, is that, you know, a lot of this tragedy that we've dealt with has really opened us up to more light and more sparkle and more shine. And
Yes,
so
it's
I
so.
always say to myself, you know, even the one podcast I did last night, it was like, you know, the relationships that I have met because of this abuse connectivity, I actually wouldn't change it. I really wouldn't. I think that it has brought more of myself out. I think it has reminded me and all of us to love harder, to love ourselves harder,
Oh,
to
yes.
be assertive, not to question things, you know, go with your gut, all the things that, you know, women struggle with in general, let
Absolutely.
alone when they're being pushed down by this male control aspect. But so
Absolutely.
I had no idea about any of your stories. So I'm very intrigued by just your light and your love, and you're very, you know, well educated about it too. And I think that's something that I'm learning more and more too, is that a lot of victims don't have the opportunity to kind of cross over into the survivor world, if you will. They don't get the resources and the opportunity to actually end up as you have, you know, with this great foundation. So you're just this bright light of, you know, this shit happened and it was real, but look where it can take you. You know,
Listen.
look, you know, it, you really are just like this glowing, you know, it all happened for a reason. And even as awful as it was, I just think obviously that the universe and God knew that we needed you in this way.
Listen, I appreciate that big time, because if you had asked me, Jen, 10 years, 11, 12, 13 years, that I would be doing any of this work in any small way, I'd tell you you're freaking crazy. Okay? I'd be like, you're out of your freaking mind. Because this, I mean, okay, so you said something really spot on in your response earlier. You said that my father really helped to shape who I was. Yes, in more ways than one. Remember, I
Yeah.
told you that I always said that the way he treated my mother would never be me. Granted, I love my mom. I wish that she would go or run away with us, which she did at times, but she always came back. Either he would find her and apologize in some sort of his own way, or she would leave and until he calmed down and then come back. Okay, maybe it was for a night, maybe it was until he left to go to work, because sometimes the attacks would happen when he, just before he went to work. I don't know how he functioned like that. Beat your wife to a pulp and then go to work
Hello.
and function. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I just cut out for just 1 second. So yeah, you're
I
good.
was saying that I don't know how anybody could function with beating your wife to a pulp and then going to work, like, you know, and perform. I don't know. So I was about to turn 16, and I'm lying. I was 14, and my grandparents, who lived in the States since the 70s, wrote a letter to my father asking if they would let me, he would let me come to the States to finish high school because they saw a lot of potential in me. And he obliged, and he let me come, and I went to school. Everything was great. I was here on a student visa. Had to go back to Trinidad to get my permanent residency status at the time. I then later became a citizen. But then when we went back, we are now growing up, all of us, my older siblings, myself, my two younger siblings. And we weren't standing for him to put her his hands on her. So we always said, you can say what you want, but don't ever touch her again, right? And with that, he started realizing that he was losing some of that power and control. And 2 years after I went back to get my permanent residency, 2 years after that, I got it. And he let my mom then migrate to the States with me and myself and my two younger brothers. So he let her go because he realized he couldn't have that full control as he did before. And he wanted to move on with another woman. That's neither here nor there. So come to the States. I start going to college, went to Suffolk University at nights, got an entry-level job in corporate America. I'm balling, right? 21, I got dollars coming in, right? So I'm entry-level secretary and I'm working for this company. I'm the junior secretary for the vice president of customer service at what was called Filene's. And so I would have to go up on the floor where the customer service reps had their do the you know to drop off paperwork. This particular guy would always try to get my attention. Finally, I gave him the time of day and took my number. We started dating. Things were good. Comes restaurants, picks me up, comes and picks me up for restaurant dates. We go on walks in the park. I mean, it was out of a movie. For 3 months, it was bliss. I had never gotten this type of attention before. And lo and behold, 3 months into the relationship, I started suffering from allergies. So I called into the office and I said, you know what? I'm not coming in today. I didn't know what allergies was. I had never had it before, so I thought it was a cold. And I told them, I said, you know, I'll come in the next day. They said, okay, rest up and be easy. 15 minutes later, he's calling my phone and he said, where are you? Why are you not at your desk? I called and I didn't get you. I said, you know, I'm feeling sick. I said, you know, are you gonna bring me some chicken soup? And he said, chicken soup. And he hung up the phone. 15 minutes after that, he's ringing my doorbell. So this is during the week. Everybody's at work. My grandparents lived in a three-family house. We occupied the first floor with them. So nobody's at home. He comes, he rings the bell. He brushes past me when I open the door, goes to the room that I occupy, starts rummaging through, looking through my stuff, looking under the bed, looking very paranoid behavior, looking behind the curtain, looking in the closet. And then he turns to me and he says, who was here? And I said, what do you mean? Who was here? I know you stayed home to, hang out with another guy, in so many words. And now I am freaking out because I'm like, where the hell is this coming from? It was almost like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. And so I'm sitting on the bed, I'm getting scared, and he comes up to me and I said, you really need to calm down because you are really overreacting. Nobody's been here. Comes up to me and he says, I knew you were too good to be true. Slapped me so hard, I saw stars and stormed out. I'm sitting there trying to figure out what the hell just happened. Like holding my face, crying, questioning myself. Maybe I should have called him because we always talk, and that's a big red flag that I missed. because he was calling me at least seven times before I got to the office every morning.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't, I thought it, oh, he wants to make sure I'm safe, you know, and not realizing he wanted to make sure I was where I said I was at any given point. So missed that and questioned myself and said, you know what? Nope, caught myself. I said, nope, I didn't do anything. I'm over this. I'm done. I make my own money. We don't have, kids together, house together. I'm out of here. Went to New York that particular weekend because my birthday was coming up. And I said, you know what? I'm going to treat myself. Went to New York, had a great old time. I said I was going to come back the same night. I ended up renting a motel and going to shop, got my hair done, the whole nine. When I came back, my brother, that's 2 years younger than me, met me at the door at my grandparents' house and said, somebody's been here looking for you. And I said, who? And he
Oh,
said his name. And he said he dropped
wow.
off something in the bedroom. So I go in, and he had delivered 2 dozen purple roses, my favorite color. Didn't relate it and didn't even know that domestic violence awareness was a thing at the time. But again, favorite color. And he knew this. And the card said, I miss you. I love you. I'm worried. Call me. Because also, when I went to New York, I turned off my phone. Remember prepaid phones back then? You know, nights and weekends were free. After seven was free. And so I had turned off my phone to save my minutes, but I also didn't want to hear from him. When I did turn it on when I got back home, there was a slew of messages from him saying how sorry he was, that he has fallen in love with me, and that I drive the thought of me potentially being with someone else or cheating on him drove him so crazy that it made him do that. So immediately, the first attack, he immediately deflected and put the blame on me. And I didn't realize that, right? It then had me again questioning myself that maybe I overreacted. Look at the lengths that he went to apologize, right? And I immediately equated what had happened with my mom to what was happening with me. And I diminished what had happened to me. Okay. I minimized it. And I said, you know what? It's not that bad. And it was only one slap. You know, my father never went to these lengths to apologize to my mom. So, you know what? I'm going to give him that chance. And I returned the call and I accepted that apology. And a lot of the times, people often ask, how do victims even get into these types of relationships? Like, what makes you even take that person back after something like that happens? And that, Jen, is how easy it can be because I considered myself very smart. Okay. I considered myself a smart, well-rounded, sort of, on her way to being educated person book-wise. And this, I'm letting this take place. That's how easy. That's how easy the cycle. That first I'm sorry is how the cycle, because then the next I'm sorry didn't happen till 2 weeks later, where he almost crashed the car on the highway. Somebody was trying to talk to me at the club that we were at when I used to go clubbing. He went up to the bar, got some drinks. He sees the guy talking to me. Meanwhile, I already know how he's going to react to somebody coming up to me trying to talk to me. And so I'm trying to get the guy, listen, my boyfriend's at the bar. He's going to be really upset. The guy wasn't trying to hear it. He sees the whole interaction, blames me for inviting the guy somehow over to me, and drags me out of the club. Now we're living 2 weeks later. We're now living in my mom and my two younger brothers. We're now living in our own apartment. To get there, the fastest way was the highway. Get on the highway. He's swerving the car erratically, reaching over, strangling me, reaching over, punching me as he's driving. And I'm saying to myself, okay, this is how I die. This is exactly how I die tonight, because that's the level of fear that he was putting in me. Got off the highway, thankfully, pushed me out of the car, drove away. What does Laverne do? Pick up the phone and immediately try to call him to apologize for what I caused.
Oh my gosh. I had no idea. I mean, that is one of the major incidents that I, excuse me, endured. And I always find myself kind of not so much anymore, but especially back then, I think it's really hard for people to imagine somebody being able to strangle you while they're
Oh
driving.
gosh, yes.
And You know, it's just, and it, we have the proof of somebody actually witnessing him driving this big ass truck and doing these things to me. But in my head, I'm allowing other people to dictate how it must look to them. Like, oh, that's not
Oh,
possible. Like, people only think it happens in the movies, you know?
right. Which is insane to me. I mean, just the very premise of what you're explaining and relating to is something that, again, people on the outside looking in are like, yeah, you're exaggerating, and there's no way that that could have happened. But it did. It did.
Or
It does.
what did you do to
And what
provoke
did
it?
you
What was it?
do? Listen, the very last night that he beat me, the night that I got to my breaking point, fast forward almost 2 years later, I now have my own studio apartment. And he would come and frequent, spend nights there. I had a day bed that was big enough to fit him and I. And I'm doing okay, right? I live next to the train station, and I'm going to work. I'm on my way to getting my own car. Everything is going good, except for the abuse that I'm taking, and it's built up now to a point where my body's numb, Jen. He beats me, I'm numb. So this particular night, he comes in, and I knew something was going to jump off. I just knew from his demeanor. Immediately, he comes in the door. Who's been here? Again, the paranoid behavior. I said, nobody. I've been waiting for you. So by this time now, I'm isolated. I don't talk to my friends. I don't speak to my mom, my brothers, because they knew from the outside looking in and closest to me that something was off. Regardless that I was keeping it secret, they knew that this guy was bad news. And I stopped talking to them because it became this Bonnie and Clyde type of thing. Like, you don't understand us. And he apologized, and it's not as bad. And I'm going to try to keep as much as I can from you because you're going to get upset and keep being upset. And I love him. Okay. So this particular night, he comes in, he's rummaging through stuff, same paranoid behavior. There were a stack of books that sat in the corner. I was an avid reader back then of novels. And so this one particular book that there was more than one. He was rummaging through a bunch of books. And this one particular book, it was Waiting to Exhale by Terry McMillan. I had read that book cover to cover. And that and the other books had moved with me throughout my time that I had come back to the States. And so he's shaking and shaking all these books, and out pops a picture from this particular book. He picks it up, he looks at it, he was light skinned black, so he got the reddest I had ever seen him in the face. He flings the picture at me and then storms into the kitchen. And I'm hearing him rummaging. When I picked the picture up, because I'm sitting on the day bed, I look at it and I died inside. It was a picture of me and my ex-boyfriend from Trinidad sitting on the beach, hugged up on the sand, looking very happy. And that picture, when I moved to the States, or I should say moved back, we were still quote unquote boyfriend and girlfriend, and we were going to have a long distance relationship. That lasted all of 2 weeks because I found out he was cheating on me from Trinidad. So I always caution people, the long distance thing, think twice. Anyway, that picture I used as a bookmark in 1998 and forgot about it in the darn book. And he looked at that and then came back into the room with a knife. And this was the first time that he had ever reached for a weapon. It was always his hands that he used or his foot or something. And he had the knife in his hand and he said, I'm gonna slice your throat. I'm gonna kill you tonight and nobody's gonna find you. And you know what? He was right. I believed him inherently because isolated from family and friends, who am I gonna call? My job, even if I don't show up to work, they're not gonna miss me for a couple of days. They're probably gonna call. You know what I mean? Like, nobody's gonna find me if this man really kills me tonight. He then straddles me on my day bed. And I'm back down, looking up at him, and he's over me, and he has the knife up against my throat, pressed up enough to let me know that he could slit my throat at any time. And he's saying to me, "You effing bee, I knew you were doing something." He said, "What are you doing? Having phone sex with this guy?" He said, "What are you doing? Sending him money? What are you been making a fool of me this entire time?" Puts the knife down, punches me in the face. Now, this is the first time that he had ever went for my face. From that first time that he had slapped me.
because he knew I worked in a corporate setting and people would ask questions if they saw bruises. So it was always about the body that he would hit. And so this night, he starts punching me in the face. He's punching me on the upper torso mostly and my upper hip area. So a lot of blows. He's strangling me. I'm like almost passing out at times. One particular time, I came through and he was spitting in my face. Okay. So he would stop the beating, press the knife up against my throat, get off of me, pace the floor, yell profanities, come back again and straddle me, beat me. Knife up again. Like it was a repeated process. And this started from 9 the night before till 2 o'clock the next morning or so. And when he was done, he laid down in my bed next to me like nothing had happened. Like he was tired, and went to sleep. Like normal. And I laid there next to him because where the heck am I going to go? Who am I going to call? This is what I have conditioned myself to accept because my dad did it, people in my neighborhood did it back then. This is what love is. This is what it is. I have to accept this. Okay? And so I, about 4 o'clock that morning, felt the sharpest pain I'd ever felt from this attack. Like I said, I think my body had become numb to the other blows that he had given me, but this was like unlike any other. So about 4 o'clock, I'm like, crap. It feels like a big, like a dagger trying to pierce through my skin. So I'm like, okay, Laverne, you could be bleeding internally. I don't know what that feels like, but I've watched movies. I said, or you could have like a bone broken or something and it's trying to pierce or whatever. You have the decision whether or not you're going to lay here, suffer through it, or get your butt to a hospital. I lived maybe 7 or 8 blocks from a hospital. Not something you can walk, but I made the decision right there and then. I'm out of here. I got to get myself out of here. So I quietly got up, got dressed, put on a pair of jeans, a light top, and a little jacket, and limped downstairs. I lived on the third floor of my building. And when I got downstairs, I lived next to a train station, so there's always cabs. And I told the driver, I said, please take me to Kearney Hospital, which is nearby. He listened. He drove, and the very first light in between, I think it's the only light in between where I live to the hospital, it was red. As we're waiting for the light to turn green, my abuser pulls up next to the cab. He realized I was gone and got in his car and followed the cab. Okay. He's now yelling out of the car, get out the cab. If you get out the, like, infuriated. I told the driver, I said, listen, if you do nothing else, if you have to run this red light, I beg you. I said, because that is my ex. Now I know resolute. I'm saying it out loud. That is my ex-boyfriend. I said, and if you let me out, he will kill me. He listened, he watched.
The guy still yelling out his mind, and he ran the red light. As he runs the red light, he's now drag racing the cab. When he sees that the cab pulls in or takes a left into Kearney Hospital, he speeds away. Back then, I didn't understand that me potentially going to say something is what would have got him to stop. I just knew, all I knew in those moments or that time is that I loved him, but I wanted the abuse to stop. So I go into the ER and I said, I fell in the shower. I don't want to get my man in trouble. There's this stigma around the Black community that you have to keep the Black man safe, right? Society has this thing out for against our men, and you don't want to be a sister that puts the brother in jail, right? So like I already have that in the back of my mind. On top of the fact that I'm scared, on top of the fact that I don't want people knowing what happened to me. So I go in there and I lie. Oh, I fell in the shower and I hit the places that I said were hurting me. And so they ran x-rays conducive to that. When the ER doctor comes into the room maybe 2 hours later, he pulls up a chair and immediately he says to me, who did this to you? And I said, I'm sorry, what? He said, who did this to you? He said, because these injuries aren't consistent with you falling in the shower. He said, I can get you help. What do you mean? What does help even mean? In my mind, I thought the police were going to get involved. So now people are going to come to my building, right? It's my building is a mix of professional people and other people, and it's like I don't want like the what people know me as is a professional person. I don't want anybody coming to my space thinking that I'm causing drama, right? So the police are going to get involved. My school's going to find out. My parent, my mom and my brothers, my extended family, my friends are going to know why I've been acting the way I've been acting. Like, I didn't want any of that. And then on top of that, you're telling me that it could potentially get into a shelter. What is a shelter? What is that? From what I knew from on TV, that's a big open room with beds with a bunch of women that I don't know. No thanks.
Right. And I think at that point too, you're thinking, that's not me. That's not me at all. Like, I don't need Yeah. I think it's interesting though too, and I did want to bring it up, that I do feel that you know, like the culture, the race and everything, that you saying you had to protect him even more. I mean, I look at it too, you know, when you come from an abusive marriage where somebody has a prominent job in the military, it's the same feeling. Like, I couldn't possibly, you know, put this on him because, you know, his job and how he's seen in his job.
Protect.
And I do think with the culture and also just the race in general, that it's something that people don't really take into consideration, but it's huge.
Black women have, and you know, not even that. So I didn't, granted that I did not feel this piece, but I hear it over and over again, is that, you know, Black women have this additional piece that they have to, right? So white cops show up.
Absolutely.
Right, they don't know, they might get arrested, right? It's happened. I've seen it happen. They might get arrested because, you know what, you're belligerent. I don't like the way you're coming across to me, because they don't understand. Immigrant Black person doesn't know the language.
Right.
They feel like they're coming off of them, but no, they're trying to express, and, you know, just all of these things that they have to consider when calling the cops. Right. And so I didn't feel that piece. I felt like I would have been understood, again, my feeling, but I still didn't want the attention. And so the most dangerous time for me, I decide that I just want to go home. I was diagnosed with upper hip and torso contusions, which meant that he had punched so hard that the flesh on the inside had been swollen and bruised. And that's what I was feeling, like something was trying to pierce through my skin. And so it could be treated with ice and meds. And I wanted to go home. I didn't realize that was the worst mistake that I was making. When a victim decides that she's done, he's done, that's the most dangerous time for them. I go home. 2 weeks, I'm thinking myself, you know what? I'm going to do my darndest never to pick up the phone and call this guy. I'm done. I need to live, and I cannot live like this anymore. 2 weeks pass. I didn't hear a thing from him. 2 weeks to the day he calls me. I let my answering machine pick it up. He's yelling and he's saying, pick up the phone. I know you're home. You just did, you know, you just put your hair in rollers and blah, 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 because he knew my routine from back to front. And so I pick up the phone finally after about the seventh voicemail. Remember those live answering machines then, right? So you could screen your calls.
Oh my God.
After the seventh voicemail, I pick up and I said, listen, you cannot come here anymore. I'm done. Man, what do you mean? What do you mean you're done? I am done. You almost killed me 2 weeks ago. He said, man, you know you looked for some of that. That was his response. And that right there reiterated to me, nope, I'm done. Now, the only thing that I had done, because I was so fearful, is that I told my building manager that at the office that I had been involved in a situation, and I do fear that he's going to come back. He does have keys, and I would like the locks changed. I'm thinking they're going to change the locks. Since then, that has changed. Victims aren't responsible for changing their locks or whatever if they're in fear of domestic violence. But I had to pay for the main doors building lock to be changed, as well as the entry door that you got buzzed up into, and then my door that was in, you know, to my apartment. So expense on me, didn't mind it, paid it. So I said, you can't come here. The locks have been changed. He said, what? He said, what is wrong with you? He said, I'm coming over. I said, please do not. He did. He showed up. What he did, he waited for someone to exit the building, and then he slipped in through there. So he comes, and the next thing you know, he's knocking my door. He's banging the door. I need to talk to you. I said, no, you don't want to talk. I said, I am done with this. I never want to be with you anymore. That infuriated him. He said, I'm giving you one last chance. He left, came back 5 minutes later, and started banging the door, but also, like, I was hearing like a scraping on the other side of the door. So now I pick up my landline because now I have the courage to pick up the phone and call the police. Call my pick up my landline, and it was dead. And I had no minutes on my cell phone, but I remember somewhere in passing, somebody had said, if you call 911 emergency, you will still be able to get through. So I prayed to God, dial 911. 911, what's the emergency? I said, somebody, still protecting him, somebody is trying to break in my apartment. He, on the other end, hearing this, says to me immediately, you're bluffing, was the word he used. You're bluffing. And I continued to talk. When he realized that I really was talking to someone, I heard nothing. And about maybe 3 minutes later, because the dispatcher had me stay on with her while they came, 3 minutes or 4 minutes later, Boston police showed up. And when I opened the door, I told them that I tried to call them from my landline, that somebody was trying to break in. I heard like scraping on the other side. He sent a detective. He said, where's your phone lines? I said, it's in the basement. He sent a detective down there. When he came back, he said, this person really had intentions of getting to you. He said, they cut the phone lines in the basement. And he said that scraping you heard was him using something like a crowbar, to get in between the locks, to pick the lock. So he had all intentions of getting in there and harming me, Jen, and making sure that I had no contact with the outside world that particular day. That's when I finally, maybe even a couple days later, because I needed to digress from what had happened, I didn't stay at my apartment that night. But then he started leaving when he realized that cops had showed up to the apartment. I'm sure he was around when they came. So he knew now that he wasn't going to come at me physically, right? Because he knew that I then really did call cops. But he started leaving derogatory notes on my, my then car. Anybody who Fs Laverne is getting sloppy seconds because I had her first. I mean, that's the type of stuff he was writing and
Oh my
leaving on my
God.
frippin' windshield that I would have to go make sure I got downstairs early enough that nobody had walked by and saw it. So that's when I finally got a restraining order. All right. I went to court. I didn't understand the whole process. Now I'm 23, and trying to figure out what the heck to do, go to court. I felt like I was raped, quote unquote, all over again, sitting on the stand, having to finally now voice to the judge why I needed this restraining order. And but they gave it to me and an automatic year restraining order. And he finally disappeared with that. He adhered to it. But as we know, many times abusers do not adhere to restraining orders. As we know, oftentimes people get to the point where they, you hear on the news, she was getting ready to leave. She was getting ready to take the kids. He had had enough, and it turns into a murder suicide or murder or one or the other being harmed because over it they would rather see you with them than with somebody else or by yourself living and thriving. And it's sort of an over my dead body type of deal. So I do
So,
not
where is he
know. I
now?
do not know. He adhered to that restraining order. I will tell you that maybe, God, this was about maybe a year before the pageant that I had taken place in. I saw him randomly in another town where he used to frequent, that I had to meet someone there for like a lunch date or something. And we were walking and he, Laverne, oh hi. But at the by this time, I had already sought therapy, not through a DV agency, just for myself. I sought therapy, and not that I had made peace with what had happened to me. But he had no dominance over me. So seeing him, it was like I feel sorry for you. You know, like I understood a
Yes,
little bit
absolutely.
more. And how are you? Wow, you look good. Thanks. So what are you doing with
I
yourself?
know,
Like, what
yeah, exactly.
I'm great. I said, but you know what? I have to be somewhere, and I'm close to being late. So, bye. And I've walked away, I mean, with a sense of self that I knew that I did nothing to bring that on me. It was never my fault. And it wasn't until later when I, as I said, I took part in this pageant and had these two titles and then wanted to volunteer at a shelter that I had to get, you know, take the DV, to take the DV 101 course. And that's when I started understanding how this cycle a lot of the times begins to repeat itself. My father, my God, his dad beat his mother. I mean, there's at least one instance where she ended up in the hospital because he beat her with a washing board. Those things that you, the wooden apparatus that you would scrub clothes on back in the day. And so I know for a fact that he grew up watching this, right? And this is what he knew from his father on how to love a person. So even though I kept telling myself that would never be me, I subconsciously also took from my dad how to receive love, right? Yeah,
exactly.
My mom showed me that it was completely normal as well. God bless her.
Well, and I think too that something that I remind survivors about, and something that I spoke about in my podcast yesterday, is that for me to make peace with everything, you know, I always look at the good of what happened, the love that was there initially. And I would tell survivors though, like, you know, it's a lot easier to love this person than it is to hate them when you're in that crux, because you're thinking to yourself, you know, I did this to myself. Like, I just need to, I need to show him more love and then this wouldn't happen.
But that's also what's being told. And so, let's not forget. A lot of the time, they are ingraining in you from very early on, as he did me. He immediately deflected blame, and it was always something that I did to cause this. So before you know it, you are are deep in this mentality that, you, like you said, if I love him more, he will stop. He said he's going to change. I need to believe that. And you're always hanging on to, like you said, the beginning piece that you saw. That really was a ruse, right? Because they never, if you really love me, you would never treat me this way. And so you're hanging on and clinging to their life for this person to return when they were really never there.
Yeah. Well, and I struggle with that though too, because do you feel that these types of humans, because I won't say that it doesn't happen to other to men, that men do get abused too, but what we're focusing on, that do you believe that they can change? Do you believe after these kinds of incidents that these human beings can change their behavior and love somebody truly?
I've seen it. I know at least two guys. One of them happens to be the gentleman that hosts our gala, which is another initiative that we host every year. I've seen it with him. I've seen it.
Okay. I feel like I see it with my ex. I mean, well, I think when all the ducks are in a row for somebody to feel calm about where their life is going, I mean, not to make excuses, but I do think that people can change.
But here's the hard
part
is that they have to want it. We hang on in these relationships believing that we can play a part in that, not understanding that they, like us, as victims, we have to make the choice that we're all set. We have to make the choice that we want better for not, maybe sometimes just for us, but for our kids. We have to make that choice. And so it's the same with them. They have to understand they have a problem. And the biggest part with abusers is that they never take accountability. It's always somebody else's fault. And that's where the hard part comes in. We, a lot of the times, can say we accept the fact that we have become victims and we need help. We need counseling to unpack everything that's happened to us. We get that. For abusers, my God, they've lived this, you know, this, there's no way. What? I have a facade to keep up. I mean, people know me as this guy. There's no way that I'm going to admit that something's wrong with me to make it look like she or he was right this entire time. There's no way that I'm going to go sit down and talk to somebody. Oh God, black man, counseling, therapy on the whole. What are you? There's no way. You crazy? Batterer's intervention. Sure. I'll do it. Because the court says so. I'll pay my money. It's required.
Right.
That's
it. It's required.
But other than that, no, they're not willing to do the deep work that it takes to get to the other side a lot of the times, but it can happen.
Yeah. And I do think accountability has been this very strong word that has popped up in every single podcast that I've done. And I just love it so much because it really is the foundation for everything that we do. Yep. When we hold ourselves accountable, yes, everything both just ways. Falls into line.
Both ways,
you know?
Victim and abuser. Okay?
Yes. Absolutely. Yep. Yes. 100%. So how do you think, as far as everything that you've been through and, you know, trying not to blame yourself as far as getting into that pattern you never saw yourself getting into, how would you say that all this has affected you in your successful relationship that you obviously have with your husband now? Like, how do you, that's something I'm still struggling with as far as feeling betrayed and kind of leaving that resonate. What parts of you did you dig deep on so that you could have a successful relationship?
Just going back to, so first of all, more therapy, right? That wasn't the end of it there back then. I did take, so when I started dating my husband, so mutual friends introduced us. Let's just start there. And so I really felt like they had my best interest at heart. But even before then, let's even take it back a little bit, just in general. How often when girls are coming up, they're told, at least especially in my culture back then, girls are told that when you date a guy, you date more than one guy, not necessarily at the same time, that you're a hoe. Okay. So I didn't even know what dating was, right? I never experienced it. I knew of it, but I didn't know it to myself. And so I finally had dated. Okay. And got a sense for who I like, what I didn't like, one date here, always in public. And, you know, and then when I finally met my husband, I was like, it just felt right. But before that even happened, I also went to counseling again to dig deep, like you said, to really own in on who I was before the abuse started. Who am I as a self? Like I laugh a lot. I like to see others happy. I like socializing. So, right. So the whole networking thing, you know where that comes from. I like socializing.
Right. Right.
And I feel good when I feel good. And I mean that by saying like self-care, quote, there's no other way to put it. Yeah. When I self-care myself, I feel good. But I only did that ever so often, maybe couple of years I self-cared. Like everything else was being poured into everybody else. And I'm not talking the foundation because the foundation wasn't even, you know, really burgeoning at that point. But like just pouring into everybody else. And so for me, Jen, it was the idea of really getting us like really continually unpacking what had happened to me with my therapist then. But then also owning in on some of the things that made me feel good. So that I wasn't bringing any baggage into the relationship. And granted, there's the residual stuff that I cannot get rid of. And this is one thing that I keep saying to myself, I need to go and sit down with someone that specializes in PTSD. Because they're just things that I cannot control even today. So we have a glass door in our shower, sliding door in our shower. And my husband in the very earlys, when he entered the bathroom, and even sometimes still now, because sometimes he forgets, he would just sort of end up like by the shower door, like playing a prank, right? Like you weren't there before, but now you're
right,
here.
Right.
Turn around, and it's because walking on eggshells with my dad, like you never knew when he was going to like flare up sometimes like against my mom or us. And then my abuser and the way that he would just lash out sometimes. Right. And so I'm always thinking that something's coming for me. I can't sit with my back to a door. Like I'm on alert, even my kids. And it's like, mommy, like we're the only ones in the house, right? I have a 7-year-old and a 19-year-old. We're the only ones in the house. Like, why are you freaking out, right? And so I can't control those things. And then sometimes a song will trigger me, right? From the time that I went out with the abuser, right? And I knew right around that time, he was apologizing to me in the car, you know, driving somewhere. And I had to keep my eyes straight ahead, because if I look left or right, it was because I'm flirting with somebody else in another car. I mean, it was like paranoid like that, like sick. And certain songs from that period of time will bring me there. And it's like, get out of your headspace. Nope. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Sing it and twist it around to your own good. Sing it with conviction. But yes.
Right. I think I've learned a lot with that too, coming from that relationship where we hung out with a very popular band at the time. So that music was like, you know, it was our love language. It was our courting time. And so I know that I'm at peace with it when I can hear them again. I've listened to them many times, and so I'm super proud of that. But it's so people don't understand that too, that, you know, just the smallest thing can kind of snowball it.
Go ahead.
I do want to go back just a little bit, because I think, again, a lot of this podcast is helping me learn more about myself when I get to know other people and their perspectives and their lives. And so something that I hear is, you know, something for me, I didn't date a lot. I was not somebody, even in high school, I was considered fat. I was considered weird. I was considered people, you know, I was just considered something that it wasn't really me, or in a positive way. And then I had one boyfriend in college, and then I met Kaylin's dad, and then I met McKenna's dad. And that was, I was 33 when I had dated three people. So, and married two of them. And so even now, the residual from that marriage, I have dated around, but never really felt, except for one person, but even that person had their shit. And I just started to see the pattern, and I'm like, I can't go down that road again. But I do think, especially, it's played a huge part in why I'm still single, why I date the type of people that I do, or why I'm attracted to certain kinds of people. But I think there is something to be said about getting into these relationships with people when we didn't have that experience. We know we want to be loved. We know we want to give love. And that's the biggest thing that I've learned, is that I just want to give so much love that I sometimes am, you know, I'm like Seabiscuit. I'm blinded to half of the shit that's really going on. But as I get older, I'm better and better about discerning, okay, this is not going to, this definitely is not going to work. There's just something about it that's not going to.
Your gut instinct is coming into play, and you're listening to her more.
But it is, but I admire people that have successfully, you know, quote, landed a relationship, even with its ups and downs. I'm sure that you've worked past that, though, because I feel like there's obviously something still going on in me that I'm not connecting on that level that I'm so much looking for. So I just, the whole point being, I admire that you are with someone that respects you, gets it, you know, is not throwing that in your face, which I think is a huge thing nowadays too. It's like, oh, you have too much baggage, and oh, get over your shit. And it's just, it's not the way to approach it.
And so
I
appreciate you, girl. Listen, let me tell you something. And you said something that's very, and it's something that I try to tell folks all the time as well, is that, you know, nothing is perfect. Okay. I love my husband, but I also, because of what had happened to me, I know what, and this may not be the correct word, but I know how to create, I can't find a word for it right now, boundaries. And not in a bad way.
Absolutely.
I have to warden off my husband, but
no,
I have
not
to
at all.
Create space for me. And I had to make that sort of a priority for him to understand very early on. Okay. And so even the sort of getting, because he never knew anybody that was abusive. Even though his dad, you know, sort of left his mom in the early days, they have since reconnected, his parents. later on in life, and they live together, tons of grandchildren, whatever. He didn't know what a life like mine looked like, even from the outside looking in. He never knew anybody close to anything like that. So it did take some time for me to, as like I said, you know, the like coming in the bathroom and playing one of his pranks on me, like, that's not funny. Like, I have to have you announce yourself when you come in the shower, because I could end up hurting myself. Like, I had to have him know that, like, this is real, right? And so it's things like that that have gotten us to a point where he understands. I love him for, and I shouldn't even use the word allowing, but letting me sort of have this space to be able to do the work that I do, because he picks up the slack, right? When I'm off traveling somewhere, whether for work or pleasure, or I'm doing an event somewhere in town or out of town, he's there with our kids, right? And so I love him dearly because he understands that this is passion work for me, but and it's my thing. And there are other things that are my thing.
Yes, and it's where you feel good, like
you
said.
Feel good. And so creating that space from early on in a relationship, I hear you when you say you want to just give love, but also making sure that it's a priority. That, like I said, I don't know how else to put it, creating space for Jen as well is really important. And it's nothing standoffish. Yeah, it's nothing self-care is selfish. It's nothing... Because I did hear that from my husband in the earlys. I'm not going to lie. I think you're being selfish. You know, maybe we need to spend more time. No, it's not.
Yeah.
I need you to understand that you also have space that you can create. And since it's all good.
Yes.
Everybody's all good. Now, again, we have our disagreements. Sometimes we agree to disagree. Nothing's perfect. As much as we present what's good, I will in a heartbeat use a reference from something bad that may have happened with us to have people understand like what this looks like. The relationship goals, my I hate hearing that. My foot. Create your own goals within your own relationship. I feel like people sort of relay so hard on what they see on social media, not understanding that when the lights come off, right? You're left with yourself and your partner. What does that look like? During this pandemic, it has showed so many who are quarantined or social distancing with their partners, not just in abusive relationships, because we know what that looks like, right? For victims, it's a very scary time. But for people in relationships who, you know, gloss over on social media, do you really, or can you really spend 3 months with your partner and like them? Like, do you like them? Right? This is not, you're getting up and you're going to work. You can't go to work. You got to be in the house. This is not, oh, I got to hang out with the fellas. You can't do that either. You can't go hang with your girls on a Friday night. You're with them and or the kids a lot. So do you like them like them? Let's figure that out.
Yeah.
And then let's talk.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's been a great reveal time for sure. And I'm grateful that I didn't have anyone at the time, because I don't know how it would have turned out. But I do think it's really opened a lot of people's eyes to, oh my gosh, this is what we've been living. This is what we've been avoiding, you know, that space that we were giving each other, but it was really just because we didn't want to be around each other kind of deal. So So yeah, it's definitely taught us all a lot, not to mention, you know, it's just what a fucking year 2020 has been, you know? So
we don't know what October holds.
I just,
And it's what do you have in store this month?
No. My gosh. Yeah. Let's make a deal. Like, let's hope it's this trip to Hawaii. God, I don't want it to be a washer and dryer set. I don't need that. Yeah. Well, I just love listening to you talk. Man. You're just so eloquent and with it and passionate. And I did see, too, on your Facebook that you went to school for TV broadcasting. And I mean, you're always doing things and in the light. Yeah. And I'm just so enamored by that. I mean, you, and I think too, when you were talking about when the cops showed up and they actually, you know, they listened to you. I'm very proud of that system working for you, because for so many, it doesn't. So that was definitely a stepping stone the universe needed for you, because I think especially because you're African American, you're Trinidad, you had the barrier with the language, that I'm just really proud for once of our justice system working you're in that favor.
So much
because
I think I was oblivious to a lot at the time, because I think I had I was a little bit oblivious society wise, because I thought, you know, I was doing correct things. Like I had a job in corporate America. I'm young. I'm going to school for, at the time, marketing and advertising and marketing. And, you know, like, I'm doing it. I have my own apartment now. But again, the big piece was that I was receiving this abuse, behind closed doors, and keeping real quiet about it, because I just didn't want to be shamed or blamed. And I think that holds so many people hostage, on top of the other factors on why, which I hate this question being asked all the time. Why do victims stay? Why didn't she just leave? Blah, 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 blah. Like, there's so many factors. This is not a black and white issue. It doesn't look the same for everybody. And it's not just picking up and leaving. Like, there are so many things down the line. So I also, one of the things that we do as an initiative is we host workshops in the community. So school, you know, I've spoken at Harvard, at Tufts, at MIT, and across the board, corporations, at churches. And so across the board, I can tell you succinctly, Jen, that 90% of the time, at least three people are coming up to me afterwards saying, me too. Or I know somebody that is going through it and I don't know how to help them.
Yeah.
Or my parent is going through it and I don't know how to help. Mm-hmm. Right. And so to have that sort of level of expectancy, almost, when you walk into speak in front of a crowd and know that people are going to come up to you, it's like, Jesus Christ, who is it in this room? And sometimes I'm doing this, right? I'm able to deduce that boy is hitting his girl when he slumps down in the chair when I start to talk. Right?
Oh my gosh.
Right?
It's so true. Yes. And it's so true. People watch all the time when I'm out and about, and I can just tell that there's something off about them. And it's something I'm very adamant about too, is seeing something. I'm just more alert to it. And my thing too is asking questions that aren't very, you know, I don't want them to be invasive, but I do want them to be suggestive in the fact of, you know, do you need help, without suggesting that, that she or he is having, you know, a struggle with it. But I'm very keen to it every time. And it's immediate too, even on these dating sites that I do. Like, if you start talking to someone via text, I mean, I can tell instantly, like, is probably somebody that would struggle with where I've come from, or that they've come from that same thing. So that's something too, that it's all this culminating, the shit that we've gone through has absolutely been for us. This has been for us so that we can be better for people that may not get to this
point.
And
that's the whole point behind the work, is just really realizing if you do nothing else, you've reached at least one person, right? That knows that the situation that they're in is absolutely not normal. This isn't the way that it's supposed to be. And you don't have to accept this isn't love. Or that they have said something, and this has the information that we've given, married with their gut instinct, has taught them to be like, nope, run for the hills, all set.
Yes.
Or seek help for somebody else. And that's, I mean, that in itself leaves me full at the end of the day, Jen. It leaves me full. I can't even say how full. I mean, full. I mean, because again, what you don't know, you do not know. I mean, back then, sitting in that hospital room, I didn't even have a name to call what I had went through, what my mother had went through. I didn't even know what it was called. I just knew that it was wrong.
Right.
And I needed to get the hell out at that point. When I got to my breaking point, however, it was like, okay, what next? And a doctor, white guy sitting there looking at you, telling you that, nope, no thanks. At least, again, for me, it's a nope, no thank you. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to look down on me. And I believe that I have done a really good job of making myself look like everything's okay. So no, thank you. I'm all set. How many other people sit in that same position when they finally do decide to seek help? Like, what is that?
Yeah. Well, I remember seeing the Power and Control wheel for the first time and just sobbing. I broke down. Like, this was my life. I had no idea what this looked like. I had no idea about DV at all. And it just like this, this big boom, aha moment. Like, oh my gosh, this was my life. This was my life. Yeah. So just quickly, as we wrap up, this has been awesome. I just love your energy. You definitely have to get back out east so I can meet you and hang out with you. Definitely on the calendar, make the radar at some point.
Whatever you call, make sure it's but as my dad calls so we it, could really have a whale of a time.
hell yeah. And I just want to quickly ask, like, everything that you do and the role model that you are for not only survivors but your children, I mean, did they has all this affected you as,
so my
as
kids,
being a mom?
It's interesting. Like, so the first time that my daughter knew, you know, very much what I did, she came to understand it a little bit more from time to time. I would have her come out because another initiative that we host is we go out and we meet the homeless where they're at, right? If we're experiencing abuse inside four walls, imagine people that are living on the street. So we meet them where they're at with domestic violence resources, but we to do that, we need them to trust us. And we do that by giving them a brown bag lunch with a bag filled with toiletries. And so my daughter would help me. She would come out and volunteer with me to feed the homeless. And so she would see me talking to folks, but didn't really quite understand. It wasn't until I spoke at Harvard for the Black Young Lawyers group. I brought her along with me, A, because I wanted her to visit Harvard, and B, because I thought it was time that she sort of heard it in its entirety in this workshop that I was doing for this group. And so she sat there and she listened, and she heard people gasp, and she heard people, you know, sort of ask questions afterwards. And then when it was all done, and she came up to me and she said, you know, I never knew the totality of what happened to you. And I'm sorry, mommy. And she hugged me and she said, so now I know that you're not like 120% smart. She said, you know, and in that sentence to me said that, you know, she took away from this that she believed inherently that you had to be like a smart person to sort of not go through this. And I had her understand that everybody, it doesn't matter who you are. Yeah. This does not discriminate. I mean, there's something in abusers say to them that they think that they should be doing this and can do this to someone else, and it's completely and inherently wrong. One of the other things is her alert system has also been up when my alert system been up. So like you notice something. I would be driving by and seeing two people on a street, and I'm looking from like coming, you know, maybe a block away, and I'm seeing like hands flailing and she pulling away, and I'm already like grabbing my phone, and my daughter would be like, mommy, it's not an argument. Like, I'm getting ready to call 911. Right. So she sees that stuff. So now she is living on her own. God bless her. She's 19. She's roommating with friends, and she's working in a hospital. She's going to school for nursing. But you know, I can only hope that everything that she's heard from me, she's seen from me, that now plays out with her in her now adult life. My son, my God, he can be watching a show and he'd be like, mommy, that is not right. He's seven. He's seven. Mommy, and this was since he was like maybe four or five. Mommy, that is not right. It is not okay to talk to your person like that. Right, mommy? No, it's not right. Right? And so I can only, and my husband and I, we can only sort of help him understand. It's the same thing with, unfortunately, with racism, right? We, from a young, from since about four, we've been talking to him that sometimes some things might happen to you in class. You might be treated differently. Some other kids might look at you differently. And, you know, you have to know that you're enough, right? So we've been talking about that for a long time. And it's the same thing. I treat domestic violence the same way that I do as I treat racism. Like, you have to understand from early on, if you like somebody, if you want to talk to a girl, do not pull on her. Keep your hands to yourself. I said, you know, sometimes he would, I remember there was actually last year when he was six, he came and he told me before Corona, obviously, that they were on the playground and this boy kept running up to this one of his friends and hitting her while she was on the swing. But he was hitting her like on the leg and about the shoulder area and taps. And she kept complaining, stop. I don't want you to do it. Stop. And he said, mommy, I didn't like when he did that. He said, I went up to her. I won't want to call her name. But I went up to her and I said, are you okay? And she said, yeah, he just keeps bothering me. But to hear that type of situation play out, Jen, it was like I was doing like cartwheels inside my head. I know that. That yes. he's actually yes. approaching,
that he's saying
not the abuser, yes. but Good. The victim to make sure, right? And I say victim very loosely, right? But, you know, the premise of it all, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's the most that I can do is just sort of have them be who I want to see in them when they grow up. I can only mirror what that was, because I certainly, as I said, I learned early on from my father what my relationship was going to look like. Subconsciously, I learned from very early on what to accept. And I just don't want that to be that for them. Now, granted, they're humans. And if for some reason they become prey to someone else, I'll be there. And this is what I explained to people on the outside looking in.
Yeah.
I know it's frustrating. Because you know what's right. You know that what they're going through is wrong and that they need to leave, right? But they're not ready yet. And and it's the same premise with addiction, unfortunately. That person has to want that help, right?
Yep. Oh, it's one and the same.
You just gotta be there. Offer them. Absolutely. Always offer a lifeline. Give them the information that they need. Get educated about the agency that's in your area. Give them that number so that when they're ready, they'll leave. Even if there's no space at the shelter, there's an advocate to talk to them. Talk them down. Safety plan. All of these things and services that shelters provide, get acclimated with it. Don't wait till the fire is burning to say, oh, come put the fire out. Take preventative measures, right? And this is what and why we focus on so much on the prevention side and talking to people. So talk till you're blue in the face to your children, okay? I mean, some piece of it is sticking with them, right? Sex education, same thing. Talk to them to the blue in the face so that when it's time, something from you, you're sitting on their shoulder and that little voice from you is saying, no, don't do it. I remember what mom said. I remember what dad said, or in this case, papa said, right? It's like, you know, just talk and keep talking.
It will, some of it will stick. Okay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Your phone cut out there just for a second. It was actually when, it's like you're in a tunnel right now, but
can
when
you were now? Telling your
Yeah, I'm not sure why.
Oh, dear.
But it's like you're in a tunnel. I don't know. But it was interesting when you were actually telling the actual story on the daybed. something happened with the audio too. Like you'd hear you, but it was like it was being mirrored. It was intense. So I just let you talk, but just if you listen to it back, but it was very intense though, because it was like, it was almost like an out of body talk. So it was kind of interesting.
Oh, it's yeah. Let me move
and
to
it's, I don't know
part.
What's doing it again, but,
one second. Is this better?
All right. Hold on.
Nope, it's still in a tunnel. But now it's good. Now it's good.
How about now?
Yes, perfect. And now we're going to get wrapped up here because it's a beautiful Saturday. I'm sure you have lots to do.
No problem.
Just appreciate your time so much and your candor and your truth and all of that. It's just amazing. And I'm just so glad to connect, at least on this level.
Same.
So look forward to us connecting in person one day. And I'm just so proud of you for this foundation and
yeah.
who you are as a person from all the shit that you've gone through. It's just it's a testament to, you know, just your overall being and your grit
that.
And your tenacity.
I appreciate
so
that big time.
It's just amazing.
Jen, thank you for creating space for folks to get educated. That's a big deal. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a great thing for me to know people on
yeah.
social media and show it in a really good light, because it gets a really bad rap. And I've just had just such good positive experiences with all my social media. So I take pride in that. And I'm just grateful for the people that have wanted
yeah.
to kind of allow others to know them. Because I
Correct.
We see people's faces all the time, but we don't really know them. We don't know. So it's just, for me, creating the space was a
Amen.
No-brainer. I'm just grateful
I love
to be
it.
Able to share it with people like you. So, yeah, yes. So one of the questions, the last question I always ask is what's some music that you're into now, or what's, you
oh
know,
my gosh, there's so many, but one of my
lately.
All-time favorites, every time I get in the car, which is not super often these days, but there's an old school station that I listen to, and they always play one of my favorites, George Michael, got it, Faith. Yes. And so that's always
heck yeah.
a quintessential favorite. But I also love 112. I've been listening to their CD now when I go in the car. So I always pop it on when there's something that I want to listen to. And then I also love Caribbean music. If you Google Machel Montano, Machel, and then Montano, he is the most popular soca artist from Trinidad. And he's done collabs with Ashanti and DJ Khaled. I mean, so he's really popular, right? And so I love soca music, okay? And then the last one that I've been rocking to is Michelle Williams from Destiny's Child. When Jesus says, when Jesus says yes, nobody mm-hmm. can say no. When Jesus says yes, nobody can say no. And so the Beyonce and oh my God, what is her name? The other one, the third one in Destiny's Child. So Michelle Williams is the very slim one.
I don't
Kelly Rowland, my God, I just went blank. So
Kelly
and Beyonce
yeah.
joined her for this, because she at the heart is a Christian artist, a gospel artist, and they joined her for this collab. That I'm Say Yes is I think what the name of the single is. But I just love that it has some African beats to it. And it looks like it was filmed in somewhere in Africa. I just love the beats and dancing to it. And I love dancing. How about that? I love dancing. I don't do it enough on social media, but I do. I love dancing.
I know.
Yeah. So a song like that just marries the whole,
yes.
my faith. I've been a Christian since 2013. And so it marries my faith with you know, some good beats, right? And that I can dance and rock out to.
I will definitely be.
Yes.
I will so be checking that out because, like I said, the perspective and the just anything new like that, I always want to be enlightened by. So I can't wait to check it out.
Michelle Williams, gospel, and it should pop up, or Destiny's Child, Say Yes, or gospel, something like that. It should pop up, but yeah, okay. And watch the video. You cannot watch it or listen to it without watching the video first, so you get a sense of where the song, you know, the earthiness of it comes from.
Yes, I love that. I can't wait to check it out. Awesome. Well, I just adore you. Saturday with this will go up next Thursday at midnight. So I look forward to that.
No worries. All right. I'll share it, my dear.
Yes. Okay. So good to talk to you. Take care.
Same here, Jen. Talk to you soon.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining me on another episode of Friday Night Light. You can find me here every Thursday at midnight on anchor.fm or anywhere you find your podcast.